Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. For this episode, we're heading all the way to America to interview the author and journalist Alan Foyer. Alan's reporting on the trial of the infamous drug lord El Chapo was read around the world, and his book on the arrest and downfall of El Chapo, entitled El Jefe, is about to come out in the UK. Now, I'm a big fan of narcos, so I was very excited to have the opportunity to sit down with Alan and talk about all things smuggling. Enjoy! Welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Thank you.
We're very excited to have you. I think you are our first American guest.
My honour then.
Breaking records already. And we're here to talk about your blockbuster new book, El Jefe, which is out this month. And I've had a read of it, and it is definitely very tense and page-turning stuff. I think I felt my tension levels kind of shoot through the roof just reading all these double dealings and life-threatening situations these real-life people were getting into. So I thought we'd get started by if you could tell me a bit about yourself and how you came to be a journalist, and then how you came to cover the trial of El Chapo or El Jefe.
Sure. So I've been writing for the New York Times for about 20 years, and I just sort of started at the very bottom of the ladder, covering fires and murders on the street, and had always done a lot of crime and really in the courts, and particularly of trials. So I've covered a bunch of trials over the years. And so that's how I found my way to El Chapo, because he was tried in Brooklyn, in New York. It went to trial in November of 2018. And it was an insane 3.5 month trial. Wow. At which, 15 of his closest associates, everyone from his right-hand man to his personal secretary to his chief cocaine supplier to his main American cocaine distributor to his IT guy.
People.
It was insane. It was like a rogues gallery. Every day, some person got up and just told everything they knew about Chapo Guzman. So that's how I came to this story, because I covered the trial day in, day out for 3.5 months.
Wow, is that the normal length for a trial, 3.5 months? It sounds like it.
This was long, and it was just an excruciatingly fascinating but difficult trial to cover, because one, security at the trial was extremely tight. There were armed guards with body armor and automatic weapons in the lobby of the courthouse. There were bomb sniffing dogs patrolling the hallways. They had snipers on the roof of the courthouse. Sorry, that's my dog. And it was just, there's a lot of security and a lot of people who were there covering the trial. So it was just you had to get there very early in the day, and we were there until very late at night every day. So it was a lot. But it was great.
I can imagine. Well, your reporting was read around the world, but I'm interested to know kind of how much access did you get to the people who were at the center of it all? Or were you just kind of sitting in the gallery reporting what was going on? Or did you get to interview the people yourself?
So during the trial, there was no access to anyone. But after the trial, I got a lot of cooperation from most of the central players in the story. And one of the amazing things about the trial is that I went into the trial assuming that there wasn't going to be a whole lot of new material coming out about Chapo Guzman, who had, after all, been in the public spotlight for like 30 years. And there were books and television series and movies and, more news articles than you could imagine. And I thought, what possibly, could there be new to talk about? Mm. But the trial opened an entire new universe of stuff. And then after the trial, when I got to meet some of the central players who were involved, both on the law enforcement side and on a few on the cartel side, it opened an even wider door to stuff that was new and wasn't even revealed at the trial. It was like the backstory to all the stories that came out of trial had a very long and complex history themselves. And so that's what I was able to get to in the book.
How did you get the cartel members to be interviewed for the book? Or was it more a case of them being wanting to tell their story because it's exciting?
One or two of them reached out to me, which I thought was very interesting. Yeah, I mean, mostly you're talking about people who had been in the cartel and then left, and some of whom were witnesses for the government in the end. So, you know, I wasn't like talking to El Chapo, brother from Mexico or anything like that. These were people who had already left, but had kind of really fascinating insights into that world.
Yeah, of which I won't talk too much about because I don't want to spoil the experience of people reading the book. But El Chapo is such a massive figure. I think in the UK, maybe we know a little bit less about him. We know more than we did because of shows like Narcos and that kind of stuff. That's really big over here. But right. I think for quite a few people and maybe some of our listeners, he is still quite a, I guess, shrouded in mystery, I suppose. So can you talk a bit about who he was, like what kind of man he was, how he climbed the greasy pole to become, I think, one of the most, maybe the most powerful drug smuggler in Mexico?
I would say the most famous for sure. You can argue about power and wealth and things like that, but yeah, sure. So he's kind of like a third generation narco trafficker. You know, if the kind of earliest traffickers, sort of really professional drug traffickers in Mexico started in kind of, you know, the 50s and 60s, you know, there was a second generation that kind of came of age in the 70s. And Chapo was the third generation who was kind of apprenticed to those guys in the 70s and 80s. And he really took off on his own in the late 80s. And his talent, he had a couple of talents. One, he was incredibly innovative as a smuggler. His talent for getting drugs across the Mexican border into the United States was kind of unparalleled because he was just so creative about how he did it. And for example, his most famous innovation was the cross-border tunnel. He had professional engineers who would dig these sophisticated mile-long tunnels with ventilation systems, lighting systems, fracking, you know, and they would have like mine carts. And he was really the first narco-trafficker to do that on the southern border of the United States. And he developed a reputation for being incredibly fast in getting drugs from their source in Colombia to their customers in the United States. In fact, before he was nicknamed El Chapo, which is kind of it's a Spanish slang for kind of short and stocky. You know, people say it's shorty, which is sort of accurate. But before he was El Chapo, he was known as El Rapido because he was so fast in getting drugs from one place to another. And so that was his calling card. And really, he started as an apprentice to what was then known as the Guadalajara drug cartel. And that's, if you've watched Narcos Mexico, the story of Narcos Mexico is essentially the story of the rise and fall of the Guadalajara drug cartel. And there's a Chapo character in the series, and he's kind of like a young gopher. And that's how he got his start. But by the time he was in his kind of mid-30s, he was already making $20 million a month.
Wow.
A month. And, you know, a lot of that was just reinvested into this super sophisticated model he had. Some of his drugs would cross the border in tunnels. Some of them would be, you know, packed into family-style mobile homes and, you know, and driven across. And then, of course, the money would have to, you know, flow back the other way. And it was just, it was millions and millions and millions of dollars. And of course, as he made money, he was able to become more sophisticated. I mean, ultimately, he crossed drugs from Mexico into the United States in almost every conceivable fashion, stuffed inside plastic statues of Jesus, strapped to the bodies of obese women, you know, who could hide, you know, the drugs like literally in the folds of their flesh, in cars, in trailer tractors, flown across, just like an unbelievable wealth of ways to hide drugs.
You couldn't make it up, could you, really?
Yeah. His other sort of claim to fame was that as he rose in power and rose in notoriety, he obviously became more of a target for law enforcement, both Mexican and U.S. law enforcement. And he had an incredible ability to both evade capture and made his real fame as an escape artist, as someone who twice escaped from prisons in Mexico. And partly that was due to, his kind of natural paranoia and extreme caution. Part of it was due to the extreme amounts of money he spent bribing Mexican government officials, Mexican military officials, police officials. So he had a sentinel network of spies who were at his disposal virtually constantly, tipping him off to almost everything that the authorities were doing. And then, once he did get caught, he was captured once early in his career. He spent about 8 years in prison and then broke out the first time in 2001, hidden inside a laundry cart of dirty sheets and towels. And he was essentially pushed out, the doors of the prison by a janitor, and had paid off so many guards inside the prison that, each sort of checkpoint along the way, they just let him through gate after gate after gate after gate after gate, and ultimately into a waiting car in the prison parking lot. And then he went on, rebuilt his empire after being in prison 8 years, and then was ultimately captured again in 2014, imprisoned again, and this time managed to escape with the help of an incredible team of real estate brokers, engineers, his family, and corrupt officials.
Real estate brokers?
So they bought a plot of land a mile from the high security prison where he was being held near the city of Toluca in Mexico. And they bought what was essentially like an abandoned kind of warehouse property with a couple of outbuildings on it. And they used that to build a mile-long tunnel that went down about 30 feet, forward a mile, and then up another 30 feet. And they were able to move with such exactness and pinpoint his location so precisely. The escape team, had snuck a watch with a GPS application into it with the help of some corrupt prison guards, and got the watch to Chapo in his cell. And so the digging crew was able to triangulate his location by following the GPS signal over the course of what was like a 10-month construction project. It's insane. And the apparatus inside the tunnel that they used to actually get him out. So that, like I said, it had lighting, it had ventilation, because if you're down that far, you need a system to bring air down. And track, it had essentially like makeshift railroad tracking. And they had what was a kind of a mining cart atop which sat the motor and stripped down body of a motorcycle. And on the front of the motorcycle powered the mining cart forward through the tunnel. And they had a guy who, brought this mining cart motorcycle contraption down to the end of the tunnel where Chapo was. And he went through the hole in the floor of his shower, went down a little ladder, and they got to the other, the entrance exit on the other side, put him on an ATV, snuck him away into a tractor trailer, drove him to a waiting two private jets at the landing strip. One was a decoy, went in one direction, and then they flew him to safety. And so to get back to the beginning of all this, that was his, that's the other thing that made him famous, was that he was known to be uncapturable. And even once captured, you couldn't hold him. But ultimately, of course, he was captured. And now he is imprisoned here in the United States, in this country's most secure federal prison, where the country's sort of worst and most dangerous criminals are housed, terrorists and serial killers and, mad bombers and the like.
Not taking any chances, are they?
None. Zero.
Did he court this notoriety as well? Because he became famous because of these escapes. But then I think he was also quite a... I guess, like a fame seeker as well, wasn't he? He enjoyed the notoriety, as far as I understand it.
He did enjoy the notoriety. And in fact, in the kind of last decade of his 30-year career, while running what was, you know, by all accounts, a Fortune 500 multinational corporation, he fell in love with the idea of making a movie about his own life and went so far as to hire producers. And, you know, he hired a Colombian guy who started writing a book about his life, Chapo's life, in order to flip it into a screenplay. And Chapo was obsessed with this movie. In fact, the personal assistant who was placed in charge of the movie project, which consumed hours of his days, talked to me for this book and was kind of instrumental in helping me understand how obsessed he was about this movie project. And he would meet constantly with actors, actresses, producers. In fact, he kind of famously met with, started courting a Mexican soap opera star named Kate Del Castillo. And it was Kate Del Castillo's interest in Chapo's movie that led to her bringing aboard the American actor Sean Penn, who met with Chapo in the mountains of Mexico in 2015 and wrote about it for Rolling Stone magazine. And so he was obsessed with himself and his own story and trying to tell his own story. And I have this like 18 page pitch deck that he had put together with his assistant to like sell the movie. And they like cast the movie. Gabriel Garcia Bernal, was at least in Chapo's mind scheduled to play him. And he was going to get like John Leguizamo to play a role. And they cast the movie. It was in their own minds. It's insane.
Yeah, wow. I think everything about the story is pretty incredible. I think also including a lot of your book focuses on how he was actually captured. El Chapo ran quite a sophisticated operation, didn't he, from his mountain home. Can you talk a little bit about how his cartel was structured? And then we can kind of go on from that into how it got brought down.
Sure. So the organization that he ran was called the Sinaloa Drug Cartel. And atop the Sinaloa Drug Cartel, there were essentially, for much of its life, there were two guys. It was Chapo Guzman and his kind of longtime partner and ally named Mayo Zambada. And the structure of the cartel kind of came into being when Chapo escaped from prison the first time in 2001. And Mayo and Chapo decided to, you know, wed their fortunes and work together and share all the risks and the rewards of this business that they were in. Like any hierarchical business, they had underneath them kind of like major captains who had areas of Mexico that they were charged with overseeing. And they're generally in this world, they're called plazas. Right, you would say that I was in charge of the plaza in Acapulco, or I was in charge of the plaza in Nuevo Laredo, or you know, whatever the area was. And essentially, the business model was you source drugs, generally in South America, generally in Colombia, sometimes in Peru, sometimes in Venezuela, and then you have to get the drugs from the source country up to Mexico. So there was a whole infrastructure that they put in place of guys who were sent from Mexico down to Colombia, down to Guatemala, down to Honduras, who were, their job was to get the drugs from the source country up to Mexico. Planes, trucks, ranches, airstrips, bribing government officials, like this incredible network. Within Mexico itself, there was another whole transshipment team that was in charge of moving the drugs, you know, kind of through Mexico to the border, to the U.S. border. There was another team that crossed the drugs over the border. Inside of the United States, the cartel had an incredibly sophisticated distribution network. So guys who would receive the drugs in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant in suburban Chicago, get it to a warehouse, get it to local dealers and onto the streets to American consumers. So really the cartel was able to move drugs from deep inside the jungles of Colombia all the way to like street corner of suburban America. Mm. And even more than that, they did the same thing to Europe, Canada, to Australia. And, you know, the general rule is the further that the drugs had to travel, the more the cartel was able to charge for them. And then, of course, atop this whole kind of transportation and distribution network, they had a security network, right? Because this is like what FedEx and, you know, Walmart do every day. You know, they move products all around the globe in a super sophisticated way, but they do it legally, right? Mm-hmm. So these guys were undertaking the same logistical feats, but they were doing it completely illegally. They needed a security network to protect the product along the way and fight their competitors if need be. And then they also needed a kind of like spying bribery network to infiltrate government, pay off police, corrupt militaries simultaneously to make this whole thing work. So it's an incredibly sophisticated organism that is doing everything that FedEx, like I said, that FedEx or Walmart is doing, but on the wrong side of the law and in secret. Yeah. You know, it's like the old story. They say that, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers did the same job, except Fred Astaire did it, you know, forward and in flat shoes, and Ginger Rogers did it backwards and in high heels. So these guys are doing these incredible feats of logistics backwards and in high heels.
These, obviously, drug smuggling is probably not strictly legal anywhere in the globe. So when did Guzman's operation come to the attention of the FBI?
So he had been on American law enforcement's radar since the late 80s. He was first indicted in the United States in Arizona. And that case goes back, it has roots in the late 80s and early 90s. Most of the cases, and you know, he had, by the time he was ultimately captured and brought to this country and tried, there were seven separate indictments in seven separate cities. So he'd been on the American law enforcement's radar for a long time. But the first real sophisticated attempt to try to capture him from the American point of view did come in 2000. It started in about 2008 when the FBI in New York City got the most surprising thing ever. Somebody walked into the front door of the FBI headquarters office in New York and said, "Hey, I have heard that Chapo Guzman, the world's most famous drug lord, is employing this 20-something-year-old Colombian IT guy who has built for him this super sophisticated cell phone network that is encrypted and uncrackable." Mm-hmm. And so most of the people in the New York office of the FBI were like, "Yeah, right. What are you talking about? That's like nonsense. You're telling us you just walk in the door one day and just drop this story on us that some young Colombian kid has built the world's most famous drug lord, like his own private version of Skype, basically, before Skype was even that popular." And everyone was like, "Okay, thanks." But there was one agent in that office who was really a techie, unusually so for the FBI, and he kind of ran this case down, and it led to what was ultimately a 3 or 4 year long investigation where a team of FBI agents tracked down, confronted, and turned the young Colombian IT guy and made him their spy. And he helped them infiltrate the super secret encrypted communication system that he built for Guzman. And it's just like an insane story of how they found the guy, how they ultimately convinced him to, you know, to come to work for them, and how they then were getting, I mean, what amounted to real-time communications intercepts on Chapo's, almost his entire communication network.
Because they tapped his whole network, didn't they, in the end? And they were getting texts like, oh, you know, change, this is what I want the bathroom to look like, kind of thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, that investigation, which was codenamed Operation Serverjack, it had a series of parts to it, and because Chapo was incredibly finicky and paranoid about his communications, he would change up his communication systems constantly, because the communications, when you have an empire as large as his, with as many employees as he had, like I was saying, going from, you know, the jungles of Colombia to the streets of Chicago, communications is essential. And secret communications is even more essential. And so the first part of that operation targeted this secret cell phone system that was, for its day, you know, like 2008, 2009, and 2010, was pretty sophisticated. I think, you know, these days we would probably look at it and be like, yeah, it's not that great. But at the time, these FBI techs were like, we've never seen anything like this before, the way that it was encrypted. But because they had the IT guy, they essentially were able to capture the transmissions back and forth between the cell phones, which was all internet-based. You know, they were using, you know, a voice over internet protocol technology, which at that time was pretty new. They were able to, like, essentially grab the communications as they were moving from server to server. And they had to involve, you know, law enforcement in the Netherlands, because the servers were physically located in Holland, and they would get these intercepts and would have, exactly as you said, kind of like everything from office gossip about who was up, who was down in the Chapo office, to, you know, when and where drug shipments were being located. At the same time, Chapo had a separate communication system that he had put in place mostly for his many, 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 many girlfriends and mistresses. And he eventually used the same system. It spread to kind of some of his close security chiefs, lawyers, essentially people who he didn't really trust, but wanted to keep track on. He gave them all BlackBerries. The first system was just using regular old Nokia cell phones. The second system, he gave them all BlackBerries. And before he gave them these BlackBerries, he had this young Colombian IT guy install a spyware program on it called FlexiSpy. And what FlexiSpy does is, if you have a FlexiSpy infected BlackBerry, the guy who infected it, Chapo Guzman, has secret access to all of your texts, your call log, everyone you call, and your GPS location. He can also, with the flick of a switch, turn on the microphone of your BlackBerry and hear whatever is going on in the room where the BlackBerry is. And he spied constantly on all of his mistresses and on, you know, people in his kind of very close inner circle. And so the FBI, through the Colombian IT guy, ultimately got access to all of this FlexiSpy data, because FlexiSpy took all the texts, for example, right? Mm. And put them in a, you know, file, and emailed it every day to the managed account. So it's insane when you think about it. Because of Chapo's lust and paranoia and suspicion and sense of jealousy and betrayal, he thought he was tapping all of these people close to him, but in essence, he was tapping himself, because the texts were going both ways. So he was getting texts from his girlfriends, right? And you know, everything that they were sending out, but to whoever he was trying to figure out if they were cheating on him or whatever. But he was also, his own texts with them were being captured. And so the FBI suddenly had access to his most intimate messages to the most intimate people in his life. They also had access to all of these GPS coordinates. So they could pinpoint his location down to, like, you know, the decimal point on an almost real-time basis.
Like, is that how he got caught in the end then?
So that's how they went after him the first time. February of 2012, they tracked him to Cabo San Lucas, the resort town, in southern Mexico. And there was some interagency American rivalry between the FBI, which had been conducting this long-term investigation, and the DEA, which has kind of jurisdiction on the ground in Mexico when it comes to American law enforcement operations. But ultimately, leveraging the GPS coordinates from the Blackberries, they pinpointed his location to an oceanfront mansion, and they sent in a team of Mexican police officers, and they missed him. Chapo made it literally out the back door as the Mexican attack team was going in the front door. There's a lot of suspicion that the Mexican police unit involved in this, which was subsequently shown to be compromised by corruption, may have tipped him off, may have purposely gone to the wrong house first and made a lot of noise and alerted him. The upshot was that after this huge surveillance operation, he got away and remained on the loose for what amounted to another 2 years until the DEA picked up the ball and was able to, again, using Chapo's different now sophisticated communication system, track him yet again.
Yeah, I won't ask you too much more because I kind of want people to be piqued, interest to be piqued enough to buy the book, which is what I hope we've given them a taste of. So I think to kind of wrap up the conversation then, what's one thing, if anything, that you hope people will take away from reading El Jefe?
I mean, what struck me most in kind of doing all the research on this is, one, what an incredibly sophisticated operation the cartel was. And so, you know, I tried to give a sense of the scope of it. Like, it's an immense accomplishment that if a guy like Chapo Guzman was on the right side of the law, he could run a Fortune 500 company, presumably. And then on the other side of the coin, it's the idea that that both US and Mexican law enforcement were able to leverage this incredible communication system and piece together in the most sophisticated way possible a kind of picture of the cartel, which is, you know, hundreds if not thousands of, you know, individual employees through the intercepted communications, and then use the data that they obtained through the communications to figure out locational, you know, like, instructions of where to go and when to be there to catch this guy. It's a remarkable feat. And so those two things, you know, and which were kind of in constant tension, you know, the book kind of describes three surveillance investigations that led to capture operations. It happened once, he got out the back door. It happened again, they caught him, and then he broke out of prison. It happened a third time. They caught him, and they got him to the United States, and they put him on trial, and then that's sort of the end of the story. But that's what I would, you know, like people to get from it.
There's a quote I really liked from your book, actually, that said, I'm not sure who said it, but it said that the law enforcement only had to be lucky once, and El Chapo had to be lucky all the time. So right. He only needed his luck to break once, which I guess it did.
We're
glad it did, otherwise I guess your book would be still ongoing, a work in progress.
I mean, yeah. I don't think he's going anywhere. Although if he does break out of prison, I would gladly write the sequel.
Yeah, could be persuaded.
Don't see it happen. Don't see it happen.
Well, thank you so much for spending your morning chatting to us, or to me, that is.
Thank you.
And El Jefe can be bought from all good retailers and also bitebackpublishing.com. So everyone, please do go, UK audiences at least, please go check it out. So thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Vicky.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If you enjoyed listening to the exploits of El Chapo, then why not head to bitebackpublishing.com to find out more, or check out Alan's great reporting on the New York Times' website. And as always, don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time!